Accession number 9420, Reel 19.
Mr. Bill Gilman, Reel 19. You were telling me about your visit to a library when you were on the Libraries Committee.
Oh, yes. Then, of course, the doorkeeper said to me, well, what is your business? And so I said, it's with the Chief Librarian. So he said, well, can I know what it is? So I said, no, it's with the Chief Librarian. So he said, well, I'm sorry, sir, you've got to make an appointment. So I said, I want to see him personally. All you've got to do is to tell him that someone wishes to see him. So he said, oh, I'm sorry. He said, without an appointment, he said, it won't be possible. I said, will you tell him then that Councillor Gilman, I said, wishes to see the Chief Librarian? He always said, I'm very sorry, sir. He said, you didn't say who you were. I said, no, well, was it really necessary? I said, I just really asked as a citizen to have a word with the Chief Librarian. I said, and nobody would want to see the Chief Librarian unless it was official business. So he said, oh, well, come this way, sir, he said, and I'll show you in and see if whether he's engaged or not. So, of course, I got the interview that I was needed, because I had to introduce myself as the new councillor. But I said, I had to smile to myself, and I mentioned the episode to the librarian on conditions that he didn't reprimand the man for doing his job, because he was quite unaware of who I was. But I had to smile to myself to think that how official it all was in those days compared with now, when people demand and walk into people's offices, more or less, in these days.
Could you tell me now about what positions you held as the war approached, and what preparations were made in West Ham for the war?
Well, of course, we gathered that war was impending, and then when, of course, Chamberlain came back, and you know what happened there, that Hitler had broken his promise, and then war broke out with the nations in Europe, and we knew that we had to declare war on Germany because of our pledge to Poland. And, of course, then there was an instant preparation, and although we weren't actually attacked by Germany as a result of that for the first year, we, of course, immediately plunged into preparations such as the provision of gas masks and the appointment of air raid.
How did you go about issuing the gas masks? Was that your response? Which committee took responsibility for that?
Oh no, this was done by the town hall administration. All the issue of the actually what happened then politically was that all committees of the council were suspended from operating except two. That was the emergency committee, which was a new job, new committee that they created, and the finance committee, which of course had to cover the finances of the borough. I was elected onto both of them. The emergency committee dealt with all matters affecting the borough and that were in turn affected by the incidents of war. And, of course, they would be dealing with the such things as directions to the officers for the issue of gas masks. And then, of course, the provision of shelters. There was an immediate rush so far as supplying shelters were concerned in the gardens of people and in public, the bigger shelters that were more or less were built up with reinforced, apart from brick and concrete, they were sandbagged all round. And all the matters that were affected, so far as protection of life and limb was concerned, provision and orders were given for blackout and the usual precautions, because we were expecting air raids, which fortunately didn't happen for some considerable time. And it was really Hitler's mistake there, because if he'd have started on us then, we would have been more or less unprepared. But to give everyone credit, nationally and locally, everyone was, there was a certain amount of scare going on then. People really had the wind up, and they were expecting the siren to go at any time. And of course it didn't go till about 9 months afterwards, when there was the first call was a dummy call, and everybody got frantic and rushed to the shelters, and those who hadn't got gas masks rushed up to the ARP headquarters to get some. And there was a bit of a kerfuffle went on with regard to that, but it was all sorted out. And
how did you introduce all these measures? Would you get told from above what to do, and then your committees would just tell the officers?
We were in constant touch with the government on this. We were getting constant orders from I forget the title of the government department that was dealing with this, but anyway, it was the same as when McDonald's son came down, because he was, I think I mentioned it previously, that he came down about the evacuation, I believe. I mentioned that.
Not on tape yet, no. We'll come to evacuation, you know.
Then again there was a question of evacuation of children.
When did that arise?
That arose during that first year, and almost as it was hastened and it was speeded up because of the incidents of the first raids, when they first took place, which were very light raids, and only 250-pound bombs for them were dropped by the Germans. And, of course, that hastened the evacuation, and it was because there was some difficulty in getting the evacuees away. The government wasn't helping us, that Malcolm MacDonald came down to our control to see how things were, because we were complaining. And we were a county borough, and of course some size, and we were a proper military target with the river and the docks and the railway centre we got and all the factories. And I remember saying to him at the time, I said it out of turn because I wasn't holding any office, only as vice chairman of the emergency committee at that time. And when he was making excuses, it was difficulty in finding trains and places to help to receive and evacuate children, and I had to blurt it out that, well, if you can't do anything, if you won't provide us with the means or help us, then you better come down and we'll leave it to you to evacuate the children. And of course it had a very prompt effect, although I was and reprimanded somewhat by some of my colleagues for talking to a minister in such a way. Although I was surprised, because it was desperate in those days. I mean, war was on us, and having had experience in the First World War, I knew there were certain points at which there was no laws operable, and you had to take the law in your own hands and decide on, and same as you did when the incidents took place. So, of course, we got the necessary permission and arrangements, and maybe got to quite a... we've got thousands of our children out of the town and away into the country and the various places. And then, of course...
You mentioned the control. What was this control?
What would happen? We took over the housing offices in the High Street, Stratford, and it was a very big building with three stories next to the Times, which caught fire because of incendiary raid on... that was when I was trapped in the fireplace, in the fire there, when I tried to put the fire out next door, because I knew it threatened our place. But that was all built up and protected with sandbags outside. That was how we recognised it was more protected than any other building in the high street there. And, of course, there was a basement too, which was very convenient for us, and that was the actual control room.
What went on there? How was that room organised?
All telephones. There was several. There was a bank of telephones there with the telephonists, and of course there was a separate room too for the officers and the incident. What we call the incident room, and in addition, of course, there was. On the next floor above, there was a couple of billiard tables for the recreation because it was manned 24 hours. And, of course, we were in constant touch with it and getting reports through from the various wardens. And, of course, wardens' posts were set up in the various areas and sectors that covered every ward in the borough. And that was one of the jobs I had. It was more or less self-imposed because I set up a band of daredevils, of cyclists. Have you had this?
No, carry on.
Of course, I realised, owing to my previous war experience, that we had so many lines of communication had been destroyed during the war that I suggested to the council, that on the committee, in the emergency committee, I asked permission to set up a band of daredevils, because they were being called up. It was no good asking for men over 18, so it had to be between 14 and 18. And the council considered it and thought it was a good idea, because I pointed out the danger of bombs probably destroying communications, that the only means of communication would be by means of cyclists, same as it was dispatch riders in the First War. They agreed to that. They provided the helmets, and I provided an armband with some letters that I got from Woolworths, from 1 to 36, because I had 36 of them. I probably got about 40, but anyway, I know I reused 36. This was the only means of identification. They had to use their own bicycles, which they had to agree would be painted yellow so as to distinguish them, not get them stolen or easily identifiable. And we paid for all repairs to the bicycles and all that to the youngsters, and we made it clear to them there could be no question of insurance or compensation, because this would be the result of the ordinary risk of war. And... under those conditions, I mean, we did get a band, and they were proper devils too, and I wasn't supposed to take them before 16, or before 16, but some of them were younger than that. As a matter of fact, in the raids during the war, I had two of them killed and a number of them wounded because of these explosions while they were carrying on their jobs, carrying messages. And when there was no raids on, they used to station themselves at the warden's posts on my direction. And I had an office provided for me inside the building at in the High Street headquarters. And I had a number 1-2, because I still had to earn my living as well. And in addition to that, I joined the Home Guard.
We'll come to that. So, did they have a rota then?
Yes, it was all drawn up very efficiently and properly. You know, they were allocated to certain places, on duty and off duty and so forth, because there was nothing else for them to do in those days. I mean, if they had a job, of course, they asked for it to be fitted in, and we helped them in every way we could. And they used to carry messages and help at the depots too. The rescue, there were depots for several schools were evacuated by the children, and of course they were taken over and then and turned into depots where the ambulance sections were stationed, so many ambulances, so many rescue vehicles and pumps, and firemen had their own headquarters, of course, but everything was there with the equipment necessary for dealing with incidents as a result of bombing.
Now, you were on the emergency committee, the vice chair, and you were on the finance committee. What exactly was the limits of the sort of responsibilities of those two committees, and how did they fit in with the sort of military government side of things, you know, military requirements and the requirements of the government? How much democracy
there
was left?
There were consultations took place from time to time. As a matter of fact, we went on visits and courses to various... I went on to a place down near Ascot Way where the a mock explanation was given on the floor, all drawn out, and officers there from the various departments of the military explaining what the effect would be if there was a gas or contamination from bombing took place, and what the extent of the contamination would be if a certain bomb dropped, and what provision would be made by the forces and various departments for dealing with the damage concerned, and how they would deal with the casualties and so forth. It was very explicit and all that, and of course a lot of it was imaginative. I mean, they hadn't actually experienced anything of this, so they all had to rely on what they could visualise might happen and prepare for it accordingly. It was more or less close to what the effects of bombing and that sort of thing.
Who actually decided what would be done, both in preparations and then afterwards? Was
ministry,
it the government?
The government controlled everything at that time. And so they sent there was a ministry of which Malcolm MacDonald, who I spoke about, was the chief minister dealing with that, and it was his ministry that more or less dealt with the civil affairs on the operation of war.
So the council, of which your two committees were all that was left, in effect, they no longer were sort of at the top of a thing, they were just part of the chain of command coming down.
Oh, yes, because each council had to appoint a controller. This was the actual chain of command. That the council, the government insisted on each council area or borough area to appoint a controller and assistant controllers. And they made us, I was outside, we were made in pairs as we were a big borough. We decided that we would have a controller and two assistant controllers in pairs. There was mainly us two, that's all, because I was vice chairman and Colonel Luscombe, who was on the opposition, and of course we more or less forgot politics, but same time we had to try and merge it together because we were all in a common danger, as you know.
So as vice chair of the emergency committee, you were also vice controller?
Assistant controller, and Colonel Luscombe was inside. As outside assistant controller, I had to chase the bombs as they dropped, because the warden, I used to constantly patrol round the borough. I was provided with a car by the council, and I used to go round the borough. And when there was a raid on, I went out to find out where the bombs were, and, you know, because I was immediately informed by all the wardens, they were only too quick, they knew what was going to happen. And then I used to go to the nearest warden's post as soon as I found the bomb and where it had dropped, and phone up my inside system controller, and then he sent the various services out in conjunction with those who were in the control. And that's how it worked. So we got the system working hand in hand, on the spot, and in the control, working together. And we sent the services out. There were so many, they decided on the report that they got from my area outside on the incident as to how many ambulances they were needed, how many rescue vehicles and so forth, you see, to deal with the incident.
Would there be a council official with you as well, or would you be on your own?
Oh no, there were council actually full-time people employed under the committee, you know, that were employed, the same as the ARP officer, air raid precautions officer, and
would they come with you to help assess the damage?
No, they'd stay in there because their job was to give the orders to send the various vehicles out and deal with the incidents as they come in, because a raid, you never knew what the extent and proportion of it was going to be. And you might get 7 or 8 incidents. On the other hand, you might only get 2, you see, so...
How would you cope if the incident... Say there were only 2 incidents, and one was at one end of the borough and the other was at the other. Would that not mean that there was a delay?
Warden, the warden on the spot would ring in too. If I wasn't there, obviously, I couldn't be anywhere. I mean, but it was covered with wardens, and the communications all went into control. That's why we had a bank of telephones, because if we had a heavy raid, then obviously there would be half a dozen calls come in at the same time. So obviously the telephone system had to deal with that.
Would you go to the worst, the area that seemed to be worst hit, or how would you decide?
Yes, if I was at control at the time, and, you know, I used to go back to control. Obviously, I wasn't on the move all the time. And as I say, I joined the Home Guard at the same time as that.
We'll come to that.
And the result was that I got very often raids took place while I was in the control. And I still had to keep in touch with my daredevils as well and make sure that everything was going all right with them. So, it worked very well, really. And later on, I became chairman of the emergency committee. And
when would that be?
That would be halfway through the war. And
how did that change your function? What did you do then?
Well, then I took the chair of the emergency committee, and obviously, I ceased to be assistant controller as such because I had the chairmanship and all the responsibilities attaching to it, and had to have more work to do.
What were those responsibilities?
Well, a close liaison with the town clerk and the engineer, and with the military and the Home Guard itself, and the police, and all the various civil services that were involved in it. We held our monthly meetings in the emergency committee, and the finance committee operated because of the payment for and employment, etc., of the various services. Not the operation of them, the operation of the services... especially the extra personnel that was engaged in connection with the service of the emergency itself, were paid, had been taken on, appointed by the council, and of course, so far as their activities was concerned, they had to report the emergency committee, and so far as the payment was concerned, the salaries, of course, that was where the Finance Committee was required, and that was the only reason for the existence of the Finance Committee, of course, to make sure that everybody was paid during that period and things were ordered and paid for and dealt with properly in a proper orderly manner.
So it was very much the secondary committee of the two, the finance.
Actually it was, but it was a committee you couldn't do without because the treasurer was in control there. And, of course, it was a question then of dealing directly with the government on the question of a payment for various things, same as vehicles and supply of vehicles and all this kind of thing, you know, and...
How was it decided what rate to set and other such things?
Agreed by the government. They were all set down by the government. All the salaries were sent down for the appointment. It was mainly governed by the population of the area that was affected by it. And I thought it was very efficiently managed. We didn't really run into any actual difficulties with the government at all at any time, only at that occasion of the evacuation, which I mentioned. But we usually got what we asked for because they regard us as quite a responsible body, and they didn't have to send anyone down from the government to see and help us to do our work because we were able and sensible enough, I think, to realise that ours was a red area. You see, it was regarded by the fire people as a red area. A red area was one which had a very high fire risk. And, of course, we had our own brigade at the time. And we had help, of course, and then there was the Auxiliary Fire Service, the AFS, had been set up too by the government itself, which of course was another angle on which the Finance Committee had to be involved because of the payment of these people. And in fact, there was an enormous amount of things and detail that nobody would have ever dreamed of if it hadn't been for the war. And it taught us a lot of lessons. We were, for the first year, as I said, before we had the raiding in earnest, was we used to run innumerable mock rescues, and we used to use derelict houses and break windows and lower stretchers out with bodies on, you know, tied up, and volunteers. It was all volunteer. People, they said, some people have said that if there was a war now in 1986, nobody of them, the population, wouldn't rally, but they would. I mean, when a common danger comes and it's your country, then you get that marvellous sense of patriotism, and I think it's partly self-protection too that causes it, that makes a country really stand up for itself, and it shows its true characteristics and colours. That's what we found in both wars, as a matter of fact. And I went through both of them and took a very active part in both, and I was amazed the number of conscientious objectors who I respect because that's what they believe in. If you're a Democrat, you accept it. But the number was infinitesimal compared with the enthusiasm and the need to protect ourselves from what we regard as a common enemy.
Was there any shortage of people to take on all these extra roles in the AFS?
No.
So the Army and the Navy weren't pulling too many people away from...
Oh, no, we had... That's what I was saying, that is the tenor of what I was just saying, you know, that there was always somebody eager to do something, and in the same way as you had the spirit of them when they used to go down the tubes and they'd be singing and all this while raids were going on even, you know, and as long as they felt they were safe, it's the human element, I suppose, that if you feel you're safe, you're brave, put up a lot of things.
So the early panic you were describing from the first mock raid and the first raid, that evaporated?
Oh, that was only to get masks. That was the only panic that took place that I ever experienced. Even when bombs were dropped, I mean, and there was a lot of casualties and some... you could hear people screaming or groaning, you know, sometimes because of the injuries. The outside public were willing to come and help. I had reason to order one of my own colleagues in the Labour Party at the time. He was well known. He was on the Trades Council, and at the same time, I was on the Trades Council. And I think I was on the Trades Council. No, I do. No, I gave it up in 1933. That's right. I had been, but I was very well known. And of course, I was a member of a trade union as well at the time. And I had to order him off when he happened to be on an incident just before I got there, and he got hold of a woman's arm through some timbers where the thing had been smashed by a heavy bomb, and he wouldn't let go. And I said, look, I said, because I sent for the incident, because that was one of my jobs as the outside assistant controller. I had to, waiting for the incident officer to arrive, I had to tell him to let go of the woman because a doctor had arrived, and he was waiting to give this woman a jab of morphine or something, and he just wouldn't let go. And I said, you've got to let this woman go, never mind about whether you think that she's going to die or anything, and he refused, and I had to call the police inspector.